Welcome to this session of SA. This is a newcomer meeting. The topic is stepping into action, getting started. My name is Glenn. I am a sexaholic.
Hi, Glenn.
In the spirit of the fifth tradition, to carry the message, this session will be recorded. The recorder will not be turned off during this session. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may participate by listening or attend another session. We ask that those who choose to share step up to the microphone so that those who listen to the recording can follow the discussion and the flow of what we do say. We do ask you that you turn off your cell phones or pagers or put them on vibrate. Those who care, please join me in the serenity prayer.
God, grant thee the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thy will be done.
Sexaholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. There are no dues or fees for SA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. SA is not allowed with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sexually sober and help others to achieve sexual sobriety. This is the panel discussion. The panelists, Matt S. from St. Louis, Malcolm M. from St. Louis, and Glenn J. St. Louis. Thought I'd keep it simple. Each of our panelists will share for about 10 minutes or so on the topic, getting started, stepping into action, basically a newcomer, what a newcomer does to step into action, get started, how to get your feet on the ground. Then we'll open up the meeting for sharing or questions. Again, we ask that those who want to share come over to sit in these chairs. We ask that you be mindful of the time so that we can have everyone share. Okay. So with that, we're going to start off with, let's start off with Matt.
My name is Matt. I'm a sexaholic.
Hi, Matt.
I'm grateful to be here this morning. Grateful to you, Glenn, for asking me to be part of this panel. And kind of just want to share my experience, strength, and hope, really, as far as if you're a newcomer, to kind of do what I did not do when I first came to this program, which was in 1995. Just to qualify, too, some of how some of the ways my disease manifests itself was compulsive masturbation, fantasy, pornography, lust in all forms, premarital sex, one-night stands, anonymous sex. I crossed boundaries I never thought I would by going to massage parlors and prostitutes, and I went insane. And by the grace of God and all of you guys, I've been sober since September 18th of last year. And so when I first came in and heard the sobriety definition, I thought, okay, so you're crazy, right? I could understand not having sex with other people, but not masturbating. I thought, okay, so that's how am I going to sleep? You know, that was unbelievable to me. And the thing is, I accepted it too, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the program, and I went to meetings, and I got sober, but I drifted away from the program and ended up getting married to having premarital sex and marrying someone who was not spiritually well, as I wasn't spiritually well. and that marriage did not last. And then I started doing things. I was living in California and started doing things that, like going to massage parlors, which I had never done before. And then I always, you know, set boundaries, and I couldn't keep them, and went further. And where I was living in California did not have SA, but they had SLAA, and I started working that program. And so, what I wish I would have not done was left SA. I wish I would have accepted the bottom line. I wish I would have had the willingness to I guess to really accept it, because I really thought, you know, I was 28 when I came, and I'm like, you know, these guys just don't have much as testosterone as I do. I mean, you know, this is just too hard. Mm-hmm. Just too hard. And because I did not accept it, my disease progressed and became addictive and destructive, and I had to put more into the cocktail. And what I realized is I did not have to do that if I would have surrendered from the first day I came in. So what happened to me was I came back to the program. The first guy, my first meeting, Glenn was there, and my sponsor now, Gus P., who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska, who he started SA in Lincoln, Nebraska. God brought him back into my life, and he is my sponsor today. And so I'll talk about getting started right now from when I guess I really surrendered is, in St. Louis, there was a meeting that was not close to me when I moved back to St. Louis, so I started another meeting that's close to me, and the meeting was one morning a week, and now we have it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings, and we work the steps on Thursday mornings. And I am a sexaholic because September 17th, my last day of acting out, I mean, I was going to die. This is a life or death disease. That's what I had to accept, too, that I was... I guess it takes what it takes, unfortunately. I wish I'd have got off the elevator 5 years ago, 10 years ago, but it takes what it takes. And I'll have to say Malcolm is one of my heroes in this program because he was a chronic slipper, just like I was a chronic slipper. I'd get 6 months and slip, 8 months and slip. And you'll hear Malcolm's story. That was his story, too. And I guess God put him into my life to continue giving me hope. The only thing that I did was keep coming back, and the obsession has been removed from my mind. I have a mind these days that I've never known all my life. Maybe I knew it when I was little, I doubt it, but to not obsess and not do the behaviors that I used to do is amazing to me. And and getting started is just, I guess, can people raise their hand who's like in their first year of program coming to meetings? Which are a lot of people. I mean, so my hope and suggestion for you is just surrender. Get into the center of the boat. You know, accept it. You know, pretty sure you're a sexaholic or you wouldn't be in this room today. You'd probably be doing something else. And because what it cost me is I've probably spent $40,000 past 13 years, and this is in recovery. I've been sober in AA all that time and been working some kind of program here, but... I continually relapse. I continually doing things that I said I would never do. So my hope is that you just surrender and take direction. I had to take direction and surrender and stop doing it Matt's way. Stop rebelling. I pray. I work the steps. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees, which is a terrific gift to my life. Helping other guys. I work on service. I've worked on the St. Louis convention when we had it there. I've surrendered that my primary purpose in life is to stay sober and help other addicts achieve sobriety. And that's what I always have to come back to. That's why God put me on this earth. It's not about that I'm going to get a job. It's not about that I'm supposed to be successful or powerful. I always have to say, I think if I make it to heaven, that God's not... His first three questions of me are not going to be, well, Matt, did you make a lot of money? You know, Matt, did you marry a beautiful woman? You know, Matt, did you have a lot of power? I don't think he's going to ask me those questions. Now, I do think he's going to ask me, you know, Matt, did you get sober? Did you do what it take it to get sober? Matt, did you help other guys stay sober and women? Did you help them in their life journey? And did you just love other people? Because that's what it's about for me. When I came to this program, I finally found love and acceptance for myself and the other guys, like these two guys, loved me up and just said, keep coming back. And so it is about action. for me. It's about action. It's about working the steps. It's about surrendering. It's about taking direction. I don't know if you've noticed, but this addict here is a little defiant, a little rebellious. Doesn't really like doing what other people tell me to do. So I have to do that. And so that's my hope for you, is to not do what I did, if you're new. My hope for you is that you don't need to take as long as I took to get sober. You don't have to go through more pain and shame. I believe we can get off the elevator if we really choose to. Because when I did, I had to go through tremendous withdrawal. You know, and I realized if you're going through withdrawal as a sexaholic, you can feel like you're going crazy. And what hit me is reading the member story is, I think it was a woman essay in there, said, really, we're going sane. We're going sane. And that's what I had to realize. I'm extremely grateful to be alive today. I'm extremely grateful to be sober today. I'm extremely grateful to be in this room with all of you. Thanks.
Thanks, Matt. My name is Malcolm. I'm a recovering sexaholic and ever so grateful to be here at this convention this time. I'm really grateful. My sobriety date is January 4th, 2003, which I'm never sufficiently grateful for. And like Matt said, I was a chronic slipper. I entered this program in 1987. In February, I was just thinking about that. That was 3 months after there was a convention in December of 1986 in St. Louis. And I missed it by 3 months. Well, fortunately, I didn't miss everything, so I'm here. My 12-step journey actually started in Al-Anon in September of 1986. I was real angry with my brother, having seen him in the summer before September, in August, and I wanted to, my father had died in 1985 in December, and my sister and I agreed to let my brother have his house. And he had all the family treasures, you know, the old antiques and the junk, you know. And I didn't want much of it, maybe a few pictures, a couple of picture albums and other stuff. But my brother insisted I take all this other crap. So I had a trailer, and my wife and my kids in a van. And we collected crap out of that house, and which I still have some of it. And but my brother's attitude was that I hadn't spent any time with him that summer. My in-laws were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary, so I spent all my time with my wife's family and not any with mine. And so he was real angry about this situation, and there was a long driveway up to the house. The front yard happened to be fairly long. And he parked his truck at the end of the driveway so I couldn't enter. And I asked him to move his truck, and he said he wouldn't. He wasn't going to do that for me. So I had to carry this crap out to the trailer. And I saw a baseball bat over in a corner, and I don't know why, but I wanted to go pick up that baseball bat and smash him with it. And that was the kind of rage and anger that I had grown up with my father, who was a rageaholic. And I somehow God protected me and did not let me do that. But that experience I understood, and my brother saw that I was incredibly angry. He had 7 years of sobriety in AA, and he said, ask me a question, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, oh no. I was in total denial over that one. And he said, well, maybe you ought to go to Al-Anon. And I thought, wow, there's something wrong with me that I would flare up like that so instantaneously and not be able to control my emotions in that instance. And so when I got back to St. Louis, I discovered a daytime Al-Anon meeting that was like 10 o'clock on Thursday, and it was mostly women. I think I was the only man for a long time. And then my wife and I were having marital problems, and so we went to see a therapist around the 1st of December of that year, and I was in this real small room, real small, with two women and myself. The therapist was a woman. And she started asking me these silly questions like, do you drink? And I said, oh yeah, I drink. a couple of, and she said, how much? And I said, oh, two beers a day. But I couldn't tell her that I got drunk on weekends and, you know, anybody's birthday or Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever. And then she said, asked me, can you remember a day that you didn't have a drink? Uh-oh, I couldn't remember a day in the past 2, 3, 4, 5 years that I hadn't had some kind of alcohol in my system. And it was like I was in training. I had to keep it there, you know, kind of keep going. So, you know, some of you understand. Anyway, and then she asked me the next question. And she said, well, can you not have a drink between today and next Monday when we meet again? And I said, well, of course. I'm a man. I can do that, you know, in the presence of these two women. And I was able to do that. And I stayed sober for the whole month of December, January, and in the middle of February, I was on a job, I'm a musician, and this other person was talking about how my former position, I had left the big job, and telling how my position was being filled, and it just produced an angry response. It was unbelievable. I wanted, after that job and so forth, to go cash a check and go across the river and go berserk in a topless club or something, porno shop, whatever. But for some reason, when I got home, I picked up the phone and I looked in the phone book for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I asked them, is there any fellowship whatsoever for people with a problem with sex? And they said, yeah, there is. And they gave me a phone number, and it was like you had to call this number, and this lady would call you back. It was some kind of answering service, and then they'd give you another number to call and so forth. And I followed that path for some reason, and it's only God knows the answer. He wanted me around, I guess, and because I was ready to kill myself in a way, you know, slow but sure, with alcohol and sex addiction. And I followed that path, and I found the meeting. That I was 12-step, actually, by two guys. One of them is here. And in the middle of that week. And then on Saturday, we had a meeting. And of those two guys, one thought I wasn't going to make it, and the other thought I was. Didn't think that I'd show up on Saturday, you know. I showed up, and I thought, oh, my God, these people are crazy, you know. When I walked through that door, you know, that painful door. This program, sometimes I've only been motivated with pain. It's just been an extreme pain, too. The kind where you want to go sit in a corner and just cry or lay on the floor and pound your fists in the floor or so. You know, that kind of incredible emotion that I have to get rid of. But, you know, 40, 45 minutes into the room, I don't know when it happened, but, you know, these guys are telling my story. They're telling something about me that is attractive, and you know, I do these things, you know, and I mean, there were times later that I was that guy that left the topless club 45 minutes before and walked into that meeting with all kinds of shame and crap, you know. I kept doing that, but eventually I got a clue that maybe there, if I tried sobriety, maybe something would work better for me. My wife was mad at me. Everybody was angry with me. I was out of work getting paid by a, you know, it just was, my life was in a shambles. And eventually I started getting some sobriety together, 2, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and then slipping and so forth and so on. Later on in 87, I started going to one AA meeting a week on Saturday morning, which is a step meeting, and I'm still going to it. I will never graduate, I guess. But anyway, I was dabbling in AA. I was hearing some of the principles talked about. I was hearing how people shared. And but I was still kind of crazy. And by November of 1989, on November the 13th, my brother was dying in a hospital in Boston with AIDS. And I had just gotten a phone call from a social worker who was describing how she had found him in disarray. My brother was very neat, but his apartment was just filthy, dirty. He had thrown up on things. He couldn't hold his bowels. He was just all over the place, and he was a terrible sick man. He was dehydrated. They took him to the hospital, and and try to pump them full of liquids and stuff. And I'd seen him a month before, and somehow our connection, our contact was down, and I couldn't call him and whatever. Well, this social worker found him like that, and I was going to go to a work situation, and I knew I needed something to eat. I stopped and had a sandwich. I was going to go work. Instead, I went into a part of town where there are prostitutes walking the streets, and I saw this one blonde woman in an area that should have only been black women, and I kept going around the block three or four times, and finally I stopped, rolled down the window. We mentioned money, and I was arrested for soliciting a prostitute and spent the rest of the afternoon in jail downtown. It was the most humiliating experience, being shepherded around and being in a jail cell with a bunch of other guys that I were afraid of. And I really broke down when I was fingerprinted. Anyway, that was the beginning of a commitment to this program, even though it wasn't total. But I committed to my therapist that I would go to Golden Valley the day after Christmas of 1989. And I stayed there for 28 days, and during that time, on January the 15th, my brother passed away. And it was a rough thing to have to go through. For some reason, I got up early that morning. We had this gathering room, and the five verses of the Amazing Grace were on the wall, and I was writing him a letter, and I copied all five verses down, and I put that letter in the mailbox at 9 o'clock in the morning. And my sister called at noon and said that he had passed away. And but he was a huge influence in my life. He planted a seed, the 12-step seed, which only you know how that happened, some of you. And so I went to treatment, and I came back, and my wife and I were separated, and we met for lunch maybe 2 weeks after I got back. And I knew that after that lunchtime, I would have to see her in court, because it just, it was gone. Whatever there was there, it was gone. So we started divorce procedures, which took almost 3 years with children and everything else and all this stuff. And I had some sobriety, you know, like maybe 9 or 10 months, and then slip, and then have 5 or 6 months, and then slip, and then 3 or 4 months, and then slip. It just keeps progressing, and so forth and so on. And finally, in 2003, I went to the International Convention in Chicago, and a lady suggested, or asked, why St. Louis doesn't do a convention. And I thought, I don't know. You know, but she, again, planted a seed in my head, and somehow that seed really helped me in one way, that I wanted to do something like that. And this was a service opportunity, and the only way I could do it was to get sober. And that was magical for me, I mean, in a way, because I made a commitment to sobriety. Finally, I really wanted sobriety. I was willing to go to any length, get a sponsor, work the steps, do all the stuff that people kept telling me I needed to do, you know. And you know, it has worked. It has worked. I had one more flare, you know, fling, whatever, and before I actually established my present sobriety date. And I always have trouble around the holidays. Christmas is, you know, I got to give myself a gift. Yeah, it's like the full moon. Somebody mentioned the full moon. Whoa, I'm addicted to the full moon. You know, it's a trigger for me. I better watch out. I got to be a little more careful. I got to say a few more, God help me, God help me, God help me, you know. And I learned a lot from people like Jess L. Just, I never met the man before he died. I sure wished I could have. But I listened to his tape and his CD. And it just, you know, like Harvey just said in the other room there, and I have a lot of Harvey in my head too, but he said that first thought's on me, the first thought's on God, the second one's on me. I got to deal with it, and I got to deal with it right then. I can't let it grow. And I tell sponsees, you have to nip it in the bud. When you get that thought in your head, that's where my disease is. That's where my crazy mental disease is in here. And it's been there since I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old when I started acting out to try to avoid and escape my family and my father's wrath and his manipulating and minute instructions on everything, and you can't do it right, and you're too weak, and you're this and that and everything. You can't do it right. When I was 13, I had polio in October, and I was in the hospital for 6 months. You know what? I didn't masturbate during that time. My sexual fantasy life almost died within 6 months. And I recently read an article about addiction that said 90 meetings in 90 days is a darn good thing, because it kind of clears the brain out of some of that crap and replaces it with good stuff, which is in this book. You know, all these books. This one and this one, you know. I just want to read a couple of things. And from the... what is a sexaholic and what is sexual sobriety? Thus, for the sexaholic, any form of sex with oneself or with partners other than the spouse is progressively addictive and destructive. I didn't understand that. I didn't get that point, especially the sex with self. I stopped doing the outside stuff, but then sex with self kept... That was my pal. That was my friend. That was the thing that kept me from taking a baseball bat to my father or a gun or whatever and shooting him, you know. It kept me just calm enough that I didn't do crazy things like that in my teenage years, because he drove me nuts with this minute instruction, okay. The other thing I opened this book up to is on page 84. Awareness of the unmanageability of our lives was not apparent to us at first. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that my life was totally unmanageable. We admit to that we're powerless over lust. Dash. That our lives are unmanageable. I tried to manage everything. You know, I tried to do exactly what my father taught me. Run things just... every little detail. But as we recover from shock and spiritual blindness, we begin to see how we were unable to function without lust. I was unable to function without lust in my life. Negative attitudes and dependencies holding our lives together. Reaching the point of utter despair did not always come right away. It came to us, some of us, only after we had been in the fellowship for a while. The full effect of step one seems to come gradually or in stages with the unfolding realization of our unsoundness. It is out of this inner honesty with ourselves that the feelings of hope and forgiveness flow. Step one is the one we have to really work perfectly, but we have to work the other 11 steps to make it work. So I have done those and I continue to do them, and to me, the steps are so very important. They're the saving grace. They're the new information that my brain was not able to comprehend. And so I have to keep working them, keep them in my life, and keep doing the things that keep me sober. I was just thinking in the meeting with Sex with Self, one thing I have had to learn is that when I take a shower, and this is important for me, that I have to take a moment to ask God to keep me sober in the shower. And then I use a washcloth to wash the parts of me that need to be washed with soap and water, and then get the heck out of there as soon as possible, because I am addicted to sex with self. And I don't need the internet and more fantasy or pictures or whatever. I got so much in my head now that it just is terribly difficult to deal with as is, and so I just have to take all precautions. I am in a war with this thing. When I had polio, I left that hospital with a limp and a weak leg and so forth and so on. I've lived with that for 54 years, and I know that I can live with that, What I know also, too, is that I can live with my sexual addiction as long as I take the various steps I need to and use the tools of this program. Call people. I have lots of sponsees call me. They save myself. They save my soul more times than not. But I have to continue and be in contact with God of my, the God of my understanding at all times. I cannot turn my back and go my own way. Thanks.
Okay. My name is Glenn. I am a sexaholic. Put down a little couple of notes. Talk a little bit about essay. I got an essay in 1992. And in 92, essay in St. Louis was a very, very sick dog. I mean, I just couldn't relate to anybody in St. Louis. I couldn't relate, but I had to relate because I had to stay sober. But God blessed me by sending a fellow from New York, a fellow by the name of Jim B. Some of you may know him, but he was doing some type of work, and he came to St. Louis, and he really put my program together. Some of the things, as far as this is like getting started, some of the things that he said got me started. When without it, I don't know what else. He said, Glenn, you look like you're bleeding in the water with a lot of sharks around. Oh, don't look good. He said that if you go out there, you probably won't come back. So thank God for him. One of the things, these are just some of the things he told me to do, and I did. He said, one, start drinking a lot of water. He said, drinking water is something pure, and you need to, your senses need to taste pure stuff. Drink water. Okay. Drink water. Next thing he said, get a job. he said, sexaholics need to work. Can't sit around all day thinking. You need to get a job. Okay. He said, keep your voice low. You know, when I would get excited, my voice would go up, and it was a indication that my addict was about to get engaged. He said, listen to that Jess L tape. That tape that Jess did in 93 here, mm-hmm, was an inspiration for me. He talked about being lust-free. He talked about how I can pray longer than my luster can last. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do. When I get a hit, I just start praying. And what happened, I say, God help me, God help me, God help me. And then if it's more intense, I'll say the Our Father. But what happens is that this lust, this energy that's generated from this lust is actually used by the energy I use to say the Our Father. So I'm really taking that lust energy and using it in a positive way. And I just got so much lust energy, so I'm gradually ratcheting it down. And if I work a program, I'll literally stay sober. He said, get the names of sober people and call them. He said, you know, just get the names. You know, there was a lot of people in St. Louis, and there was like four people in St. Louis that were sober at that time. Two of them are gone, but there were just four people. And he said, get the numbers of people who are sober and call them. Stick with the winners. That's basically what I got. I just got some bullet points, and I think, thank you for listening. Thanks. Okay, so it's time for sharing. You can share about what we talked about, or you can ask questions. We ask that you would come up here and speak into the mic, because this is taped.
Hi, I'm Larry, a sexaholic.
Hi, Larry.
My sobriety date is September the 1st, 1988. I get a lot of good help from newcomers and from sponsees, including those who keep slipping. I encourage them not to use the term slip, because that seems like that's easy and sliding out from under it. And so some of them use the term fall. Seems to have a little more impact. But I really like, most of all, what Dayton, Ohio group does. They don't use either term. They say an act of self-destruction. Mm-hmm. Ooh, boy, isn't that something? When I had the disclosure made and wound up in therapy, my therapist was a grandmother who was sexually abused as a child and who worked with sex offenders in the prison system. What better qualification could you have to be a sex addict therapist? She wasn't an addict. She had all kinds of book learning and some kinds of experience, but she didn't really understand an addictive personality. When I told her, says, well, of course my wife has cut me off, you know, I understood that, but what do I do? Not to be a trigger, but she says, that's why you have a hand. I had permission from my therapist. A lot of prison systems encourage homosexuality and acting out just to keep the population calmed, which is one of the reasons why sometimes SA is not allowed even to put on a program in the prison, because they want to keep everything calm. It's really important. But the comment that was made, doing whatever it takes, is also vitally important. After my wife asked me to leave, I sent a letter to my parents and my siblings. This is my new address. We have a problem, and I'm not ready to talk about it. It took me 2 pages to write that, but that was really what it was. So after a while, I was telling my group that I wanted to go and tell my family of origin what was up. They said, hey, Larry, you aren't ready yet. Okay, I listened to wiser counsel. So a bit later, I brought it up again. I got the same reply, so I waited. When I finally went down to tell them what was up, I had my sister, my 3 brothers, and their wives all come over to my parents' house, and I did my first step with my family right there. I didn't make any excuses. I didn't talk about extenuating circumstances. This is what I did, and this is what I'm trying to do to make a difference. And it did. After 2.5 years, my wife asked me to come back home with conditions, and I accepted, and I was grateful for the opportunity. And 2 years ago, we celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary in Hawaii, and we have a much better relationship now than we ever did before. They're right. Keep coming back. It works if you work it. Thank you, and God bless.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm a grateful recovering sexaholic.
Hey, Bob.
I started coming to meetings in 1984. The program was real young. I was very blessed to come into the program, and I did it my way, which is why I'm sober for 1.5 years. And you don't need to waste all that time. The desire to get sober and stay sober is all you need, but that's like saying, I want to go to Nashville, so I have to get in the car and go to Nashville. And a lot of people, the way I ran my program was, people say, how you doing? I'm in the car. Well, that's good. Been in the car for 3 months. You going to Nashville? I'm working on it. I'm going to go to Nashville, but I have a few things. But I'm in the car. To me, that's what what sobriety is now. It's a way to get recovery, and I desperately need recovery because in the years from 1984 until now, I went from a chronic masturbator and an adulterer to a sex offender. Mm-hmm. And there's no do-overs. Every time I slip, I lose something that I never get back. When I move to another level of deviancy, I can't recover from that. I can recover from that point, but I can't back that deviancy up. I can't be unattracted to the new low I've gone to. So when I slip, it's not just a slip. I lose a part of my soul. And by God's grace, I can recover from that point, but I can't go back. I can't get that back. I can't get back the time. I can't undo the new deviancy. I lose part of my soul, and someday, if I keep doing this, I'll lose the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And there will be no coming back. I'm convinced of that now, which is what, when I come to meetings, I want recovery. That means I have to stay sober. Fine. I'll stay sober because I want recovery. I don't want to just sit in the car and talk about how I'm going to Nashville someday. I don't want to tell my sponsor, yeah, I'm sitting in the car. I want to say, I've passed this point. I've passed Indianapolis. I'm on my way to Nashville. And so that's how I've come to see recovery and being sober. Sober is just what it takes. You know, it's so important. But for people that come to me and talk about their sobriety date, I want to know how far along the road they are. You know, sobriety is necessary, but recovery is essential. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Hi, I'm Sam, grateful recovering sex addict. You know, I've been really lucky in this program to have terrific sponsors that put me on the right track. And the one thing that sticks with me the most is my sponsor always says, whatever you put in front of your recovery, you lose. And it's so true in my case because when I first came into the program in another fellowship, I always put my recovery like sixth, you know. My wife was first, that's why I was there, because I was busted. I wanted to make her happy, and so I went to meetings. Then my work and my kids and everything, you know, was prioritized before my recovery. And I committed acts of self-destruction. And it never worked. So I finally found SA. I found a SA sponsor who kind of called me on that and said, listen, you know, if you want what others have here, then you're going to have to do it our way. And, you know, that was tough for me to understand or accept because, you know, I don't take instructions well. So that's one thing I learned to do is just do what I was told and to shut up. I also learned that it was a really simple program for complicated people, and that was part of my problem. So, you know, it's really simple. You just shut up, do what you're told, go to meetings, and sometime down the line it'll all come to you, and you'll go, oh, okay, so that's what they were talking about. But I didn't know it because at the time I was insane, and now I have some sanity. And I just completed my ninth step, and I just wanted to express some gratitude for that and the wisdom that comes with that, because I had no idea what the promise, it was a ninth step promises, you know. And I'd just been working my program, going to meetings and working my step, and really not thinking about the promises too much, and then suddenly I realized I'm living them, and I just completed my ninth step, and so it all became very clear to me, you know, the wisdom of all those rooms and all those sponsors and my sponsees and the whole program. It'll work. You know, you'll have those promises if you work for them. So, you know, stop arguing with yourselves and your addicts and just work the program. Thanks.
Thanks, Dan.
Good morning. My name is Ted. I'm a sexaholic.
Hey, Ted.
It says on page 77 of the White Book, everything begins with sobriety. Without sobriety, there is no program of recovery. But without reversing the deadly traits that underlie our addiction, there is no positive and lasting sobriety. To recover from a life based on wrong attitudes, self-obsession, separation, false connections, blindness, spiritual death, requires a program of action that includes a fundamental change in attitude, character change, union, the true connection, self-awareness, and spiritual life. Working the principles of the steps as a new way of living has made this happen for us. On page 143, it says, staying sober is our initial objective. A spiritual awakening is the unintended result. If our experience tells us anything, it is that there is no healing without such an awakening. And the difference between merely not acting out our addiction, being dry, and healing is the new life. If we want the old life intact, simply minus the habit, we don't really want healing, for our sickness is the old way of life. Those two paragraphs really were the challenge that I faced when I came into the program, and I read them over and over again because I don't want to be sober. I want to be better. I want to, as much as possible, get rid of this damn thing. And I know I can't. I've learned that. I know I can't. But you know what? I can get damn close. I can really, really gain a lot. Coming to these meetings, coming to these conferences, meeting with people, speaking out, changing my life. Changing my life is what I'm striving for. The guy that's driving to, that was just up here and said he's driving towards Nashville. My Nashville is a change in life. It's not being sober. Sure, it says I have to be sober to change my life. The goal is, in this program, is honesty, recovery, and healing. It's not sober. We don't say that. We say the goal of the program is honesty, recovery, and healing. If I want to recover, if I want to heal myself, I have to be honest, and I have to be sober. I understand that. But that's not what I'm doing. I'm not being sober. I'm healing myself. I have to understand that. I have to keep that as my objective. So many things have changed in my life over these 4 years. If I had all day, I couldn't list them for you. So many things, so many relationships. It's an incredible process. And heaven knows, I don't work my program the way I'm supposed to, but I try. And there was no such word in my dictionary, try, because I was perfect. And whatever I did was the definition of what was perfect, because I did it. So then that made it perfect, and everybody else was wrong. It doesn't work like that. Okay? Like someone else said, shut the... and get on the bus. Okay? Just shut the... and get on the bus. Let someone else drive. Let someone else figure out how to get there. Let someone else figure out where the chairs belong on the Titanic. It has nothing to do with me anymore. You know what? I only got to worry about one thing and one thing only. That's me. Because if I worry about me, I'm not being selfish. I'm being the best Ted I can be for everybody I come into contact with. Every time I think about somebody else before me, I'm messing up that person. Because I'm not thinking about me. I've got to keep me in my forefront. What do I have to do today to be the best Ted I can be? And if I do that, I'm working towards my healing and my recovery. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Ted. I think it's about that time. Is it about?
No, we're
over. No, we've got 10 more minutes.
So good. Hey. Hi, I'm Matthew. I'm a sexaholic, and getting started, I felt was definitely the obvious meeting for me. I started the program December 10th this last year, so a month ago, and supposedly I've completed my first step with my sponsor and working on step two, but sitting here with what's been shared, you know, I heard about, you know, this is the one you got to get right. And I have a good friend that's in recovery and other programs that helped me get in the door. And he's a chronic relapser. And we've been really good friends over the past few years. And he's had a little bit of jealousy in the past month because he's like, man, you know, those guys who wake up early, man, they're the. He's been kind of envious of how quickly I've taken to this program. And so I've been really trying to get outside of myself. You know, it's like I don't want to get down the line in this program and somebody not be able to relate to me because, hey, you got it right away. You know, you didn't go through what I did. And I am reminded that I decided I wanted to come clean almost 20 years ago to the day. So, you know, just because I haven't been in the program doesn't mean I haven't been trying to work it in my own way. That's the key. And so step one, I went to an AA meeting around that same time, and I had come clean of drugs just because I saw them as not really achieving what I wanted. You know, I wanted fun, positive, memorable experiences, and the memorable part just didn't apply, so I was like, well, these drugs don't work. So, but one drug that I failed to recognize until only even a few months ago, the memories lasted, and boy, did they. And so I've never been able to get a hold on this. I know I shared last night that, you know, I officially entered in this short period of time in the program. I had one slip that helped me see where I really was, or I had one act of self-destruction. I really like that, as I truly recognize my self-destructiveness in this disease. And anyway, so I've been going through, you know, I saw those 12 steps 20 years ago, and, you know, when I saw them, I had been clean from chemicals for over a year, and I had a really fun teenage arrogant moment that I can only laugh at. That one meeting I went to, just one, I went because a friend of mine needed a ride, and I was a do-gooder, and I was going to give my friend a ride to a meeting because their car broke down, and you know, they're getting out chips at the end, and I, you know, anybody 1 year, yeah, me, or went up to the front, collected a 1 year chip for being sober from alcohol. And I am so thankful for the long-timers on that evening that politely came up to me after the meeting. And, you know, I can't remember their exact words, but the feeling was basically, son, you know, congratulations. But those chips are really meant for people who are here working the program. And, you know, we'd like you to give that chip back. And, you know, and I was like, I was like, the nerve of those guys, and boy, you know, I've had a lot of recall in the past month of just replays of different events, and it's just amazing the darkness I walked in, the lack of awareness of my arrogance, self-centeredness. And so the big thing from the shares I've heard today that have me taken my first step even deeper was that second line. As I've been going through that one meeting in AA where I looked at those 12 steps and I kept the pamphlet and looked at those 12 steps, the abbreviated form, for, you know, the next few years from time to time, and I had kind of mentally checked them all off. Yeah, I've done those. I haven't done chemicals in years, you know, I'm good. And now I'm realizing, hey, I wasn't sober. I kept using in my own addiction I didn't recognize till recently. And what was the step that was not addressed out of those 12? And it was that second half, that my life had become unmanageable. And as a teenager, I was already in my third high school due to flunkouts. Somebody could have pointed that out to me and said, your life's unmanageable. But I didn't recognize it because I was, you know, I was working on it. You know, I'm going to make this life work however I can. I'm going to make it. Well, four high schools, five colleges, no degrees, no diplomas. Lost every job I ever loved due to this addiction. Thankfully, not because they knew what my addiction was, but just my performance started to fail. Well, re-looking at that unmanageable line, the external unmanageable was very obvious after I started working these steps and even before I walked in that door, which helped me take to the program quickly. But I know some of us who are not necessarily ready to start the program, what has dawned on me that made me prone to not accepting help throughout my life and not getting a leg up on this addiction was that that my life had become unmanageable. I, from early on, did not like what my parents taught me or what they were saying. You know, they were saying I couldn't do this, couldn't do that. And I was like, well, I'll show them. My teachers, you know, I've never passed a course I didn't like. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. I tried to design my own major and dozens of times through all the colleges without meeting the general ed requirements. Here I am with about 3 years worth of college and not even a one core general ed course completed, but I got lots of electives. So the unmanageable part I'm seeing now is I have never once, predominantly looked or accepted anybody else's advice as being any better than my own. And that, as far as the first step goes, is that this is the first time I've started to accept, that not only has my life sort of fallen apart, that's how I interpreted unmanageable, but I have never surrendered to outside management of any kind. And that has what's prevented me from recovery. So I'm truly grateful for the relatively short, the sobriety date to me, is nothing impressive. I really am thankful for those who have been here all these years to keep the door open for me. But I'm really thankful that I've entered the longest period since I discovered masturbation of being free from it. And it's just been an absolute joy, and I'm glad you're all here. Thank you.
Steve, grateful recovering sexaholic. My forms of acting out included masturbation, pornography, sex with animals, sex with men, sex with women, and paid for sex, extramarital affairs. Man, I'll keep this short. I know we're short on time, but when I first came in here, been in the program about 2 years. When I first came in here, it's a theme. I cannot stop acting out. I can't. I'm powerless over this disease. And as soon as I start to look at this program, where I have to get sober, I can't do it. I can't do it. And coming in here and people telling me you have to surrender, I've done it my way for a long time, and when somebody tells me what to do, I tell them what number they are, and do the opposite. But what you guys have taught me is that I don't have to stop acting out. I have to surrender, that I choose to take an action that I can take, and then the miracle, the magic of the program works. I don't have to act out to medicate my feelings today. That was really hard for me to get, but one of the keys to it was getting my mind around the fact that when my sponsor suggests that I do something, when somebody in the program that has a lot of sobriety suggests that I do something, they're not telling me what to do. They're giving me a suggestion, and I can choose to take it or not. I still have choice, and it's backwards. But, man, it works for me, And when I finally was able to swallow that and finally able to surrender it, I got some sobriety, And I've been sober since August 5th of 2008. And, I was a chronic slipper, couldn't get any sobriety and of length. And so, for me, the last thing I'll say about that, I had all this fear that if I truly surrendered to the program and truly said, okay, sponsor, I'm going to do whatever you suggest I do, that I was going to end up in some country speaking, trying to teach, people that didn't speak my language how to work the steps. I just thought it was going to be something that drastic. I could never get on the internet. I could never do anything. But, a good friend in the program gave me a really great gift. He said, that's your addict. Whenever you think never or always, that's your addict. You're only equipped to deal with today. So you only have to follow your sponsor's suggestions today. Just today, and as soon as you start to think about the future and what you got to do for the rest of your life, you're not equipped to deal with that. I'm not equipped to deal with more than 24 hours. So if I can stay in it, I can follow suggestions just for today. And anything my sponsor suggests I need to give up, it's not forever, it's just for today. just today. And if I do that, then I'm relieved and I don't have to act out to medicate my issues today. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing. Appreciate it. Anything you heard at this meeting is strictly the opinion of the individual participant. The principles of SA are found in our 12 steps and 12 traditions. Okay, let's end the meeting with the third step prayer. God,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Keep coming back.
It works if you work it, and you're worth it.
I got invited at home in Baltimore. A guy called me a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
Jim M. Vermont.
That's the way my brain works, Brownie. I had a thought. I don't know if you have this feeling, but when my gut says, on the east, you know, this east, and my gut, I feel like,
I realized that, you know, the